Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about deep code, which is a way to find security errors in your code. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 567, recorded February 26th, 2020. Deep Code. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Melissa. Bad data happens to good companies. That's why 10,000 businesses count on Melissa for clean, reliable address data. Get started today with 25,000 records cleaned for free. That's a $75 value at melissa.com/twit. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like Dell EMC. But it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, and Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not be aware of it, projects you may want to download right after this show and play with. Today's probably one of those. So joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, it's good to be here. Seems like I am the every other week co-host, and I'm always happy to do it.
I think you're now scoring the record for, let's say, over the last year. Because, you know, everybody else is sort of rotating around, and you're every other week. It seems crazy that way, but that sounds good. I am calling on this show from the what I like to call the TJ Kitchen set. So I'm in Tijuana, my apartment here. And remember the magnets, the magnet contest? Oops, where's my hand? There we go. I don't know where my hand is. Okay, it doesn't matter. Anyway, there's magnets back there, and one of them was moved. And then my roommate said, I should just rearrange all of them the next time so that you can't tell which one was actually moved. Anyway, so today we have an interesting project. It is flip. It is not Pamcor, that's next week. Deep Code, there we go. So Deep Code alerts you about critical vulnerabilities you need to solve in your code. Don't let security bugs go to production. Save time finding and fixing them. And that was taken directly from their website. We have one of the founders, one of the important people, Boris Paskov. I should have asked him how to pronounce this. Paskalov, it's probably close, is going to be coming on in a few minutes to talk to us about what it's all about. What did you find out, Jonathan? You said it's the AI code review or something?
Yeah, they in their literature, they talk a lot about artificial intelligence and neural networks and learning, things like that. So I'm guessing what they're doing is they've taught an AI, a neural net, about what good code looks like and maybe how to find problems. And then they, every time you make a commit, they run all of it through that neural net and then spit back at you, here's things that, you know, the AI thinks might be a problem you might want to take a look at, which is interesting. I don't think I've ever heard of anybody doing that precisely before.
Right, and it's using all the right buzzwords. So if you're playing buzzword bingo, your card's probably already a third full. So we'll see how that all goes through the rest of that. And this is a really important problem these days. Is, you know, how do you keep from sending, you know, security issues to production? You know, because you don't want to be vulnerable, and you'd rather stop it at the source rather than. Literally at the source, rather than you know, put it into production and find out, we just got hacked, you know, strange stuff anyway. So anything more before I read the ad and bring them on?
No, I'm looking forward to hearing from the source itself what this is all about.
We're going to use that word too many times today, yes. I'm pretty sure. So anyway, let's first, before we bring them on, we have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by the leader in address verification, Melissa. Every address is covered from Adelaide, Australia to Zipaqueta, Colombia, and everywhere in between. We all know there's nothing good about bad data. It costs money, hurts sales, and decreases your customer satisfaction. If bad addresses, duplicate records, and bouncing emails are hurting your business, isn't it time to come clean with Melissa? Delta Faucet, C1 Motorsports, and Cardigo use Melissa. You should too. Delta Faucet was able to improve their call center processes with global address auto-completion. Melissa was able to reduce the fraudulent e-commerce transactions for Z1 Motorsports by 90%. Melissa provides a full spectrum of data quality protection for your customer data. Verify postal addresses, mobile numbers, and email addresses. Update the addresses of customers that have moved and eliminate duplicate records. Gain additional customer insight into your data with Melissa's analytics. Easily build address verification and customer data validation into your custom application using Melissa's APIs, CRM cloud connectors, and e-commerce plugins, or upload your customer file for a quick data cleanse. Melissa is serious about securely managing your data. They continually undergo independent security audits to reinforce the commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. SOC2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. Mailers spend about $20 billion annually in undeliverable mail. Don't lose customers or cash. Make every address count. Bad data happens to good companies. That's why 10,000 organizations worldwide trust Melissa to get their customer data clean and accurate. Get started today with 25,000 records clean for free. That's a $75 value. Get melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/TWIT, or call 1-800-MELISSA to find out more. And we thank Melissa for their support of Floss Weekly. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Boris. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, guys. Thank you for having me.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I am currently in Zurich, Switzerland, which where our headquarters are.
Wow. And it's, what is it, like mid-afternoon, early evening?
Yeah, it's getting late. It's like 6:30 p.m.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I was, it's always a little tough, for Europe and other time zones over there. So give us a 30,000-foot view. What's the problem that the name of the project, the Deep Code, is solving? It's a bad morning for me. So what problem is Deep Code solving? So when would you reach for it?
I mean, in general, developers are spending 30% of their time for searching for and fixing software bugs. And this is where Deep Code comes in. Deep Code pretty much taps into the knowledge of the global development community to understand how other people have solved and what type of problems they have solved, to actually give that at the right time to each developer around the world.
And so, you know, I'm always a little scared when people are saying that AI is fixing things. What assurance can you give me that this is actually moving the state of the art forward?
So let me unpack this with two things. First of all, we're not fixing things yet. And second of all, when we speak about AI, we actually speak about augmented intelligence, which means we provide the developers with the information at the time they need it from everybody else, rather than actually telling them what to do. So really, it's not real intelligence. It's actually computers helping people code better and faster.
But even having a good report that says, we've noticed some possible problems in this file, that's useful information. It means the developer can go in and try to figure Absolutely. Out what's broken on that. So, yeah. How did this get started?
Many years of research in ETH Zurich by my two co-founders. They've published many, many papers, many, many awards in the space, many open source tools that already fixed partially different pieces of the puzzle. And after our CTO finished his PhD, we decided it's time for us to actually build that into a platform so we can really make a step function change in what the software development does today. Because if you look into the history, there hasn't been any major evolutionary steps in software development for more than decades now.
Cool. And you have a sense of how many downloads and how many people are using this?
Hundreds of thousands, let's put it that way, but it's growing. We're mainly focusing on the open source community today. And rapidly growing. We're getting absolutely amazing feedback. So thanks for our customers. We appreciate that. We're just scratching the surface right now.
And so you're working for a company that's primarily producing this. Are you getting a lot of non-company contributions, pull requests?
Yeah, most of it, as I said, we work with a very selective number of actually large enterprises that we actually can partner with. We don't really have a large sales department or customer acquisition department or anything like this. We really focus on developers. So that's why free for open source, free for small teams, free for educational use, and mainly people actually using it as a service in the cloud. So make sure they can deliver better software.
And you make your money up in volume? I mean, how do you make money when you got that kind of model?
So currently we're VC funded. We are very lucky to have one of the best venture capital money behind us. And they support the fact that we should actually make sure that everybody loves the tool. We build the technology and the platform to the level that it's more than amazing. And only that start building actually sales teams. Because we built something that is pretty complex. It's deep tech. And trying to educate big buyers what it is and why is it better just takes time. It's much easier to tell them, hey, look at it. Everybody's using it. Everybody agrees it's the best. There's no need for me to educate you. Just get it.
And you're on the senior team. Are you also getting your hands dirty and actually changing some of the code?
This year, I have not done anything. I used it maybe 2 years ago. It's getting less and less time for that. So, and when I do it, I only do it on the front end, not really in the deep things.
And what's the technology behind this? So obviously you're using augmented intelligence. Are you using anything off the shelf for that? Any open source upstream?
Most of the things are custom built. I mean, we use off-the-shelf parsers, for example. For each language, we have the best open source parser that exists out there. And after that, everything is pretty much proprietary. We have proprietary solvers to extract all the semantic information from the code, then proprietary internal representation that actually can represent all those semantic facts and really enable, for the first time, machine learning on big code. And that's all language independent. And then we've built a custom knowledge base where we can store all those facts about the code in a very efficient way. So pretty much we can have all of the history of Java, every single version, every single change ever made in memory. And then we can very easily mine that and get all the knowledge out of it.
Wow. Okay. And it sounds like fun, actually. What's the primary technology?
So most of the backend is built in C++. We have a little bit of Python. We've actually built two custom languages. One of it is a variation of Datalog for the solver. We call it PyLog because it looks like Python. And the other one is a Starlang, we call it, which allows us to mine this extremely rich big code knowledge base.
Okay. Let's see. So how is DeepCode unique?
I mean, it is for the very first time allows people to really semantically understand in depth the full history of every single line of code and fix ever done. That really does not exist today. There's many people that go into the abstract syntax trees, which gives you some perspective, but not at all goes into the semantic representation, object transition, points to analysis, interprocedural analysis. All those things really don't exist. The other thing is we've built it in a way that it has to be real time. So every interaction, every report comes in milliseconds. So you can use it at the source, as you guys mentioned earlier, where developers write the code, they should be able to immediately get the feedback saying, hey, this is a problem, I want to fix it. Instead of having somebody down the line, a QA or a continuous integration, or worst case, customers having to actually detect the problem.
Hey, Boris, I want to jump in and ask a couple of questions about this. One of the first things that comes to mind is when we talk about loading a bunch of history of code into essentially the neural net to compare against. How does the neural net, how does it know which of that code is good and which is bad? Because, I mean, obviously, if you pull all of that in, you're going to be pulling bugs in as well from, you know, historical code.
Yeah. So just to highlight, so we don't use a neural net, and pretty much your question answers why. What we use a symbolic AI, which is we have to be able to explain what the problem is to the developers, and a neural net will just tell you there's something weird here, and that's about it, right? And it's not going to be able to give you accuracy. It's not going to be able to give you an explanation what the problem is. So we're using a symbolic AI, which pretty much has metadata that actually connects to the original source. And then just to answer your second question, how do we know what's wrong and what's right? It's since that's why we use big code, right? When you have thousands of people fixing the same issue, we throw away all the syntax, how the problem was fixed, and then we actually look at it on a semantic level. So when you look at it on a semantic level, you can see what happened before each commit and what happens after each commit semantically, and you actually can identify patterns when saying when people have such a semantic problem, they change it in this way. And usually end up with a very easy pattern, like 90% of people fix it this way, and there is one-offs people that usually fix it wrongly, or they're pure geniuses and nobody still knows that they are.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so what sorts of problems? I'm still trying to wrap my head around exactly what this does for a developer. So do you feed source code into it, and it looks at the source code and it says something like, oh, hey, you have a you have a potential bug here where you're doing a check and then you're waiting and then you're using the data. You may have a race condition. Does it find those sorts of things?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, so that's the benefit that it's semantic, right? And the way it integrates with the developer is like if you know what Grammarly does to written text, right? Mm-hmm. It allows you to analyze it very easily and then tells you issues. We do the exact same thing as developers write something. We tell them, hey, what you just committed or what you just wrote semantically have that issue, and we can explain to them what it is. It says which variable calls which one, where it's being passed in, what it could be, and then what the problem is. We also can give them examples if there are other people out there that have fixed similar issues. We can tell them, hey, we have those three open source repositories. They've had the exact same problem. This is how they fix it. Here's the link to the commit. So if the developer is clueless how to fix it, they can just go and figure that out from the examples.
So we have a live chat room, of course, and they are kind of jumping at this. First question comes from Jojo Dancer. He says, what platforms can they handle? What type of code can they read? And how many millions of templates do they use?
So the languages we support today is Java, JavaScript, Python, TypeScript. We're going to be releasing likely next week C and C++. It is connected with the standard Git. So we have GitLab, GitHub, Bitbucket integrations already. We have actually IDE integrations through VS Code and Atom. New ones are coming in. Anybody interested to help, give us a holo. It's all open source in that sphere. And we also have a command line interface and API that people can just literally hook it up anywhere they want as part of their continuous integration or if they're actually using some more exotic old school SVNs or something like this.
All right. So continuing on that line of thinking, also from Jojo Dancer, he says, how do they know what I am thinking when I'm writing the code and what I want to do with a specific piece of code? And then he also asks, how do they find out when I inherit from classes that they have no access to? I think those two questions are related.
Yeah. So the first one, we don't know what you're thinking, but the idea is we analyze your code after you express your idea, what you're trying to do. And then we actually can analyze other people have tried to express semantically as something very similar, but they're doing it with a different function or with a different class, for example. And we can give you examples why this other class is better than the other. In terms of how we can understand what particular class that you're inheriting does when we actually don't have access to it is purely because we've seen many other people using the same class or the same function call or the same API, and we actually can predict how you should use it, right? We know what each variable should look like. We know in what context you're using it because we're not looking at a single line of code. We're looking at the execution of your whole program, right? So we actually know what has to happen, and we know that for millions and millions of other people that have done the same thing.
Hmm. And so is the only data set that you're pulling on just source code?
Yes, we actually work on the source code. We don't require any compilation binaries or anything like this. That allows us to really learn from every single commit happening in the past, because if you have to build something that was committed 10 years ago, good luck with that. First of all, it's slow. Second of all, it's very unlikely you will be able to do it.
So DeepCode doesn't have any ability to pull in, let's say, database data as well.
We don't look at database data. We look at source code only, correct.
Okay, fair enough. And then, as this is Floss Weekly, how much of this project is open source? Is there any of it that's open source?
So usually the integrations are open source. All of the backend is not, with the caveat that we do publish a lot of the research behind it. By the time it gets published, usually we're 3-4 generations ahead of it, but it's still pretty amazing. We have a number of master students that actually run their master theses and research on top of our platform because it really enables a lot. But the open source piece is usually the integrations. So after we have a public API to our backend, that gets exposed so everybody can really build on top of it, being that reports, other products, or integrations with existing workflow development processes.
And so where's this big bulk of data that kind of runs this whole engine? Where does that come from? Where does that data source?
So the standard one when we originally started was pretty much all GitHub. So pretty much we just ingested GitHub and then converted it. The good thing about it is our internal representation is very space and memory saving, so it's not huge. Some people actually are surprised oftentimes. And now we actually, when our bigger customers that I mentioned already, we actually use them to actually do private learning on their history, right? Imagine you're a company with 10,000 plus developers and you have quite a history of source code. There is a wealth of information there. Sometimes it's very specific to the company. Sometimes it could be applicable to the outside world. But yeah, it's that's kind of type of learning that we can do as well. We usually don't learn from the private code of our cloud users purely because that could expose some proprietary information or something else for others. So that's where the data comes from.
Yeah, so I was just thinking about that. You would surely have to have customers that would want, maybe because of the specific projects and the kind of code that they're working on, they would want to be able to say, all right, here's our learning, here's our data that you want to learn from, but we don't want this exposed out to anyone else. It's all private and proprietary. You guys handle that, I assume.
Yeah, that's standard. I mean, usually when we work on premise with customers with their private code, that stays for them only. Obviously very useful when we have like custom functions, language extensions, APIs, macros, etc.
And so just because I'm curious, what does the back end for this look like? Like the actual hardware, how much is it cloud driven? Is it on AWS, or do you guys have Big Iron yourselves that runs all this?
So there's two pieces of it. One of it is the learning pipeline when we actually learn and ingest all this data. This is a private server that we have because we calculated if we have to outsource this in the cloud, within about a month we pay out to get a big server. But think about the server costs something like in the range of $40,000. So it's not anything like extraordinary. Again, everything is about optimization and speed to make it use it the right way. But then when you serve that to the customers, it's actually super lightweight. You really need a 2-core processor, 16 gig of RAM. You can really run it together where you run your Git repository, etc. That's when it's on-premise. When it's in the cloud, we just use one of the main cloud providers. And yeah, it's very, very nimble from resources. Our bill is pretty low, let's put it that way, every month.
Sure. So an interesting potential problem comes to mind. If you are doing learning from GPL code, wouldn't you inherit the GPL in your actual database?
So we actually look at the specific licensing for every single software that we actually know and have, and we can learn from it. Some of them you can learn, some of them, but you cannot show. And then we take that into account. We have a special service that actually checks those.
You have very expensive lawyers that have looked into all of that for you.
Actually, it's not expensive lawyers. Our CTO looked at it. He looked at all of the different points and said which things we can use and what. And we only provide examples from the things that have pretty much very open licensing. Anything else we can learn from it. We say, hey, we've seen many examples of it, but we cannot show you anything about it.
All right. So that's, I suppose that's a fair answer. You've at least thought about it. we've used this term augmented intelligence. We talked about augmented intelligence versus artificial intelligence. What exactly do we mean by augmented intelligence, and how is that different?
I think augmented intelligence is something that actually helps humans do their job better by providing them right information, right knowledge, at the right time when they need it, right? Imagine you are solving a problem and you forget how to calculate the, I don't know, the area of a triangle, something very simple, a kid's like. You don't know what it is. Instead of Googling it, it just pops up automatically and say, this is the formula, plug in those two values. This is kind of the basic, simple thing. And this is what augmented intelligence gives you. It's the right information, the right time, so you don't have to waste your time. And it can check your inputs and outputs very quickly. So it allows you to do your job better. And you can focus on the actual intelligence part, the creation, the art of things that our brains can do. And real artificial intelligence should have been able to do this whole thing, the whole art piece, the whole piece of creation, which I still believe we're far away from it.
Mm-hmm. We do have another follow-up question from the chat room, basically asking, what does it look like when you're in a mixed environment? You know, when you've got a Windows ODBS accessing data on a Linux MySQL database. And so how does this work when you've got, you know, maybe you've trained on well, I assume if you're looking at GitHub, you would train on code written for Linux. A lot of it would be. Does that apply cleanly to code written for Windows?
If it's in the same language, the short answer is yes. We've actually have many examples where we can seed our algorithms with a couple of examples from one framework, and you actually learn every usage of similar context within the code from many different frameworks. So if semantically the code does the same thing or the function does the same thing, it doesn't really matter what is it built for, where it is. We actually look what it does semantically. So it's actually independent. As long as it's the same language. Today, we haven't really enabled yet the cross-language learnings. It is a project for this year, and we're already looking into it. But today is one language at a time.
Sure. And then Jojo Dancer again wants to know, he says from your website, it says, we never share code for our development with anyone. He wants to know what sort of security guaranteeing security, for our code. I think he's asking about if we entrust our proprietary source code with you, what does your guarantee look like?
So if you're in the cloud, I mean, the guarantee is very simple. So we're using the best encryption that exists out there, and we actually don't store your code. It actually sits in cache for very little, just for us to actually transform it into our internal representation, which it's. Today, it's not possible to actually have anything knowledgeable about the code. So just think about it as the DNA of your code. And then everything else disappears. And then we serve your results. And then everything disappears from cache. So we don't store it. So that's usually the most common security problems out there. People store something and then somebody breaks into it and steals it. So we don't do that. Mm-hmm. And then we use the best encryption and to actually transfer the data where it is. We use the most reputable cloud providers, obviously, that invests millions and millions every year in the best security. So in short, if you're using a cloud service for your source code, we're pretty much using the exact same thing. The only difference is we don't store it. Does that answer the question?
I'm sure if it doesn't, he will let me know in the chat room. So
we have a security link on our page that actually describes that our CTO like role specifically, but that is his number one focus all the time, because we've seen many examples in the past when if you ever leak your user code base, then you're dead in the war.
Well, I can't let Jonathan have all the fun, so let me bring you first an important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, ATC, 10 years ago, and it's grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab. The lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners, ranging from heavyweights like Dell EMC, VMware, and Intel to emerging disruptors like Equinix. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation and offers on-demand and schedulable labs like Dell EMC, VxRail, Data Protection Central, and IDPA. These labs represent the newest advances in primary storage. There are hundreds of labs to explore, including multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, networking, secondary storage, data analytics, AI, and more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the ATC lab environment so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. They offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take full advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT's engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. WWT has launched a digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. This ever-evolving platform creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers and partners. Get full access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/twit to create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. We thank WWT for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. So what's next for DeepCode?
I mean, so we're continually expanding new languages and new integrations to help developers, and we're continuously building the platform to be able to cover more and more things, being security. As I highlighted a little bit, we're actually looking into ability to actually automatically fix the code in the cases that are actually feasible. Not everything is possible today. So there's a number of new projects that actually our platform enables to be done. So that's why we have a number of researchers working on it. And yeah, our goal is ultimately that every developer should around the world should use at least one of the DeepCode services, because big data is there and developers can only benefit out of it.
Now, is this something I can download and use standalone? I heard something about the back end being proprietary. Yep.
So we have a on-premise solution, so you can download it. You actually need a link for it. You downloaded it. It takes about 10 to 15 minutes to set up. And you're going to get the exact same experience, performance that you actually have from the cloud-based service. And yeah, that's it. And you can use it fully behind your firewall, no internet connection required to the outside world.
And I presume that this has some sort of scale issue. I mean, not issue, but I mean, what's the largest reasonable size of code base that I can use with this?
Any. As I said, we are able to process all Java code that exists in the world very fast. With all of its history behind it, you can think of that way. It takes less than a day to run it all. So, yeah, there's actually no limitation. We've tested hundreds of millions lines of code and takes a minute to analyze, maybe a bit more, plus minus, but really most for average repository talking milliseconds, for very large code bases, minutes.
And so what's the biggest missing feature right now?
What's the biggest missing feature? Oh, that's a good question. I think it's some of the integrations that people require. For example, for Java, everybody's asking about IntelliJ. We're actually actively working on that. So as I said, anybody that's interested in it, just ping us. We're starting an open source project for that. Some of the languages support, like specifically for the businesses, they ask for a C#. Go is still not live. PHP, some of the standard in the top 10. Those are the three that actually we should add for the top 10. Yeah, and ongoing, our platform is based in a way that the more feedback we received about potential issues or type of issues we have to detect, we can really add those in a matter of 5 minutes or so. So the more feedback we actually receive from the users about that, including highlighting, hey, this is a false positive, we can actually address those into the knowledge base within minutes. And then every single developer around the world will be able to benefit from that improvement.
And does this integrate well with, say, a CI/CD system?
Absolutely. I mean, in GitHub, GitLab, we already have it automatically. So you just every time you have a new pull request, you actually get a check mark saying if everything is okay or not. And if you want to actually ignore if there is any suggestions, you can do, obviously. But it will tell you, hey, this pull request is ready for merging into the master.
Wow. And We're getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything that we haven't asked that you want to make sure gets out to our audience?
I mean, the main thing that the audience should know is they can start using VeepCode within less than a minute, right? Just log in with your existing account on GitHub, Bitbucket, or GitLab in the cloud, and you can really analyze your repositories in a matter of seconds. And it is free for open source. It's free for small teams. So really, in the cloud, you can just start using it today and just provide us feedback, and it will get even better.
So you said it's free for small teams. Does that mean at some level, if you get sort of an enterprise level, they're going to start paying?
Right now, it's defined if you have less than 30 developers, it's free. And if you go above that, we can just give you a call and we can start talking about how it is, as most other companies do it, to understand what your plans are.
Cool. I'm trying to think of some other questions I can ask you. I'm kind of running out here. Jonathan, you got anything else you want to ask?
I do want to jump in again and kind of track something down. So you guys are just about to add C and C++ support. I can only imagine that trying to do things like trying to find bugs in memory allocation has got to be just a nightmare. Does that work? Let me start with that. Does that work, trying to find memory allocation bugs and things like that?
So for some of them, yes. Again, some of the memory allocation bugs usually actually caught by dynamic analysis, again, which we don't do that. But a good chunk of it could actually be found by static, because people that have found issues with dynamic analysis in their memory, they have actually fixed issues like this, and we can actually learn from those as well. Again, not everything. But yes, you're right. So C and C++ was actually a tougher language. Usually for us to add a new language, it takes about 4 to 5 weeks to be fully ready. For C and C++, we took close to 3 months because we really had to upgrade our backend to be able to represent all these intricacies that we actually have in C and C++. But now that that's behind us, we can actually add almost anything in any language, which is a very nice position to be in.
So you say at some point this is actually making a semantic model. Is that semantic model, semantic analysis, is that useful by other tools? Can you use it to find out like flow paths and code coverage, things like that?
Absolutely, yes. So short answer is absolutely yes. So our internal representation is pretty much the first language independent detailed semantic representation for code, and that's why we have to build the right solvers for it to make sure it's super fast. And really, you can represent anything. It is built as a plugin architecture, so if something is missing, you can just add it in without having to affect anything else. And that's the idea of the representation is that it has to be as close as possible to the actual code, right? Really should be able to transition the code into internal representation and back into code if needed, being that in a different language one day.
Jojo Dancer from the chat room has been asking on. He's been very interested. He's been asking most of the questions that we've taken. Is there something they cannot do?
Is it something that it cannot do? I'm sure there is a number of things that we cannot do. Let us know about it, because we can add them very fast. We actually, on a daily basis now, this is what we do based on the feedback from users. But again, as I said, dynamic analysis we cannot do, right? That's out there. We don't do numeric verification. We don't do that, obviously. So there's many things that we actually cannot do, because we're purely a static analysis of your code. And some things do require actually dynamic analysis, compilation of the code, etc. We have found that there's very few of those, because a lot of the one that you require with dynamic analysis or building the code, you can actually get a very good approximation by actually having enough data of people doing the same thing. And then you can actually learn from it. It's never perfect, but you get like 90%+ accuracy, which is more than enough.
Do you get hints on things like pointer types in C and C++?
Absolutely. A pointer is a standard thing. Tracking type state, etc. That's bread and butter, which is hard for any other tools, but we've worked on it, obviously.
Awesome. Well, like I said, we're almost out of time, so I want to ask the two questions I always have to ask, because otherwise my audience yells at me. So what's your favorite text editor?
Ooh, that's a big question within our team, so I'm not going to put anything. We have people using Vim, we have people using Eclipse, we have people using VS Code, so it's quite a range. I'm not going to actually put my favorite one, because I'm really agnostic of that, since, as I said, I don't code that much on a daily basis.
Okay, cool. And your favorite scripting language?
Let's say Bash, just to have something out there.
Sure, that sounds good. That sounds good. Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you, and this is really a fascinating project. I always love it when things are developed in academic world and then moved out to open source in particular. A lot of stuff goes commercial that way. So it's kind of nice to be able to take advantage of stuff that got done in research. And it's nice that you got VC funding. Oh, Eric Duckman asks our traditional question: does it have blockchain yet?
No, we've actually analyzed with our solver some contract verification for blockchain, but we don't have a blockchain.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, again, thank you for coming on the show and talking about this project. It sounds like a fascinating project. I hope to have you back on in a couple of years to see what progress you've made towards getting lots more languages support and all that stuff. Oh, I was going to ask, you said you can put plugins. Is there a plugin repository that people are sharing their plugins with?
Yeah, under Deep Code, on GitHub, we have a number of plugins. As you said, the VS Code one, the Atom one are there. We're just starting a couple of new ones, one with a university in the US they're building. I think the Eclipse one, IntelliJ is happening by a team in Europe. So yes, they're all there, they're all open source. So allows people to quickly get and use our command line interface and APIs if they want to use it somewhere else.
Nice, okay, cool. All right, well, thank you, Boris, for coming on the show and talking about Deep Code. Fascinating project, like I said, lots to it apparently, and it has a lot of deep implications. Not to overuse the word deep, but there we go. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, guys. It was a pleasure.
Great. That was Boris. I'm going to take a stab at his last name again, Paskalev. I hope I got it that close. Talking to us about Deep Code. What do you think there, Jonathan?
What they're doing is really cool. What they're doing is really interesting, where they're looking at, this is the question I was going to ask him about when my audio died, but it sounds to me like what they're doing is they're looking at the code changes that fixed bugs. And then they're looking at current code and saying, do we see the same patterns in current code that existed in these pre-bug or these pre-fix bug reports? And if they are, then we also happen to have, because we're looking at these fixes, suggestions for how to fix your code. And that's cool. And the fact that they make it free for open source and they make it free for small teams, that's really cool. I would like to see more of their project open sourced because we're Floss Weekly and we're all about open source. But you also have the angle, and we were talking about this in the chat room, of we're in an environment now where we have to be trust no one. And the idea of handing over lots and lots of source code that, may be secret or proprietary, for some businesses, that's just not going to sit well with them. So with those caveats put out there, what they're doing, the ideas of what they're doing, really, really cool. And I'd love to see it in action. I'm kind of scared to do so, but I'd love to feed some of my work into it and see what it spits out about it.
Well, it sounds like it's a lot more than just a security upgrade. It sounds like if somebody just made this change in this GitHub repository, it's likely that that was to fix some interesting problem. And then Deep Code will let you take that patch and notify you that there's a patch that works for that. So I wasn't sure whether it was only about security or whether it's also about just general patches. So it's fun. Anything else before we start wrapping up the show?
Well, just to speak into that, after covering security for a while now, I'm kind of coming to the conclusion that all bugs are security bugs in one way or another.
Well, okay, sure. That makes sense. All right. Well, let me start wrapping up here by talking about who's coming up, because we have a lot of interesting people coming up as well. We have Let's see. Oh, and I've been misrepresenting the Linux beer wandering. To me, it sounded like it was a pub crawl, but no, it's not. It's a week. The guy who's going to be on next week to talk about this is a week-long annual unconference format rotating around Europe, celebrating its 21st birthday this year. Many people, veterans and newcomers alike, consider this to be one of the community events not to be missed. Activities include hackathons, talks, hiking, so that is actually in there a little bit, and other group activities. But the most important aspect is that having a fun week with like-minded people with which you just met or having known for a long time. So I got a finger wagged at me because I was misrepresenting it. And it's because, you know, when he first pitched the idea, he sort of implied that it was a pub crawl. So So he straightened me out. NetData is a distributed real-time performance and health monitoring for systems and applications. It is highly optimized monitoring agent you install on all your systems and containers. Xcode turns your open source project into a steady revenue stream. Wow, we could all use that. That would be nice. Yes. Agones, you can host, run, and scale dedicated game servers on Kubernetes. Ooh, that sounds like fun. Just added, and I'm going to need an Android person on that week, is F-Droid. F-Droid is the installable catalog of free and open source software applications for the Android platform. The client makes it easy to browse, install, and keep track of updates on your device. We have Hydra, which had been previously scheduled for a few weeks ago, so they're rescheduled. And we just added PIMCore, which to me looks a little bit open core, so we'll have to see how that comes out. You can find out about all these and more coming up by going to the homepage for this show, twit.tv/floss, and there's a link there, which nobody seems to be able to find, and has the all the upcoming guests. If you have a project that's not on that list, feel free to have the community coordinator or project leader email me. My address is also right there in big bold letters in the middle of the page, merlin@stonehenge.com. So you don't have to write that down. It's amazingly how funny it's really obvious. It's right there. It's a big link. Yeah. Okay. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. You can join in our chat room. You can see us behind the scenes. That's going to be fun. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Merlin on Twitter. But you can also join us and participate at the forum on twit.community. There's a specific thread or group, I don't know what you call it, for Floss Weekly there. And every week as we publish new shows, there's a new thread started automatically. So, or maybe it's not automatic. Maybe there's monkeys behind the scenes typing. It's also time for Twit's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. It only takes five. Oh, that's gone now. Okay, well, then sorry. My plugs. I am going to be next week at Scale in Pasadena, Southern California Linux Expo. So if you happen to be at Scale, please come up, and if you see me, I was going to say, please come up and say hi, but you have to be able to see me first, I guess. So that's not going to work. I'm going to be there. Jonathan, what do you want to plug?
Sure. I'll mention you can follow me on Twitter at JP_Bennett, but also over on Hackaday. I've got my weekly security column, comes out every Friday morning. And then there's another one that's in the works, should be coming out in the next few days, about Crypto AG, a cryptography company in Switzerland that was secretly owned by the NSA for years and years, and did a write-up on that and found some interesting things. So keep an eye out for that too.
Wow. Well, Jonathan, as always, appreciate you being co-host. as often as you are, especially since you seem to be the only one always available or nearly always. I guess that's the curse of having your own company.
Yeah, curse, blessing, yes.
Yeah, exactly. All that stuff. Okay, so once again, we're done. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.